He was one of the defining figures of the 20th century. His life was history and literature, a struggle between addiction and liberation, broken relationships, and enduring love. A novelist whose circle included the biggest names of his day and who would influence the big names of a generation to come. I'm Brian Ellison. Today on Central Standard, we look at the life of William S. Burroughs, who would have turned 100 next month. A new biography out today examines the journey of a boy from Missouri to Harvard and New York, to Paris and London, through drugs and sex and maybe even murder, to final decades spent in Lawrence, Kansas, where he died in 1997. How did the author of Naked Lunch, a book frequently banned as obscene, become a leading voice for the Beat Generation and an inspiration? We'll talk with his collaborator and biographer and invite you to share your memories, too. It's today on Central Standard, after the news. Who was William S. Burroughs? A literary genius or a purveyor of obscenity? A Missouri boy who came back from touring the world to settle in Kansas, or an Ivy-educated brat who wasted money and talent traveling the world in a heroin-induced haze? A legend? Or a tragic figure? Or both? Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. William S. Burroughs died in Lawrence in 1997, but not before becoming one of the most influential literary figures of the 20th century. The author of books like Naked Lunch and Junkie, as the New York Times said of him in the late 1970s, although he has created some enduring characters, he is his own most interesting character. Joining us today to talk about that life is Barry Miles, who is friend and collaborator of William S. Burroughs, and now the author of the new biography, Call Me Burroughs, A Life. It comes out today. Welcome to you, Barry Miles.
Thank you.
Joining us from a studio in New York City. Barry will be in town this Thursday night at 7 o'clock, speaking at Rainy Day Books in Fairway, and we'll have more information about that up at our website later today. Barry Miles, why write this book? What about Burroughs' life justifies a 700-page journey from birth to death?
Well, I didn't really expect it to come out quite so long, I have to admit.
These things happen.
They do. I think the publisher was a little surprised as well.
Well, there you go.
But his life was just quite extraordinary. Even if he hadn't written any books at all, he would have been a wonderful subject for a biography because, after all, he spent 6 months in the Amazon searching for hallucinogenic drugs. He lived in Mexico City when he accidentally shot his wife. He lived in a male brothel in Tangier. He lived in the famous Beat Hotel in Paris. He moved in very sort of loose circles in London in the 60s. He did the most extraordinary things. And they're also very, very funny stories, generally speaking. So I was hoping to try and catch some of the humor and the irony in him in the book. I've known him. I knew him from 1965 onwards. So in part, it was me writing about a friend.
Yeah, and you had more than just a passing acquaintance with him, right? How did you come to know William Burroughs?
I originally corresponded with him in 1964 when he was living in Tangier. And then he spent about 7 months in the States, mainly in New York. There was a little bit of time in St. Louis. And then when he came back to London, I met him through his ex-boyfriend, basically, who was a friend of mine who'd gone to university with many other friends of mine. And he became a sort of legendary figure, really, in London because he embodied all that was sort of cool. And, I was still a sort of a teenager, actually. I was just coming up to London from art school. And there was this guy who he was everything that was illegal. He was homosexual. He was taking drugs. He had this astonishing voice. A wonderful, wonderful speaking voice, and this dry humor that the kind of people I knew when I was growing up. You could not find anyone more different. And also, I loved the book. Naked Lunch was a legendary book in Britain because it was banned. Of course, it was published by the Olympia Press in Paris in 1959. And you had to smuggle copies in, and anything that you have to smuggle in, of course, takes on extra value. Everything, in fact, by the Olympia Press was banned, both in Britain and in the United States. So that alone really made him a legendary figure in sort of underground circles, bohemian circles, really.
Well, we're going to spend this hour talking about his life and digging into those remarkable stories, both the ones that were true about him and the stories that he told. But I wanted us to begin by listening to a little of, as you said, that remarkable voice. We have a clip of William S. Burroughs reading from his own work, reading actually from Naked Lunch, a bit of Bradley the Buyer, one of the chapters in the book. And we should mention that this clip contains a reference that may not be suitable for all listeners. Here's the voice of William S. Burroughs.
Drove all night, came at dawn to a warm, misty place, barking dogs and the sound of running water. Thomas and Charlie, I said. What? That's the name of this town. Sea level. We climbed straight up from here 10,000 feet. I took a fix and went to sleep in the back seat. She was a good driver, you can tell as soon as someone touches the wheel. Mexico City, where Lupita sits like an Aztec earth goddess, doling out her little papers of lousy sh. Selling is more of a habit than using, Lupita says. Non-using pushers have a contact habit, and that's one you can't kick. Agents get it, too. Take Bradley the buyer, best narcotics agent in the industry. Anyone would make him for junk. I mean, he can walk up to a pusher and score direct. He is so anonymous, gray, and spectral, the pusher don't remember him afterwards. So he twists one after the other. Well, the buyer comes to look more and more like a junkie. He can't drink. He can't get it up. His teeth fall out. He's all the time sucking on a candy bar. Baby Ruth's, he digs special.
It's the voice of William S. Burroughs reading from Bradley the Buyer, part of Naked Lunch. We're talking today with Barry Miles, who is author of a new biography about Burroughs' life. Barry Miles, does that capture the man?
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, to me, that's really, really very, very funny. I think with Burroughs, you either really like him or you hate him. There's very few people who just, can take him as an average writer. I mean, he's... some people are really, really shocked by his work, and whereas I see both the humor in it and some quite significant messages, really, as well.
So was it
he
that,
works on many, many levels.
Yeah, was it that polarizing when it was first published? There were certainly people who hated it. Were there people who loved it, too, from the beginning?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I used to hitchhike up to London, I would stay with a friend of mine who had a sort of communal apartment in Paddington, and... one of the guys staying there was a friend of mine called Peter Wallen, who later became the head of UCLA Film School, in fact. But I remember one day coming down for breakfast, and Peter said, this is such a cool Padman. There's always a fresh copy of Naked Lunch on the table. that was the sort of attitude at the time, that Naked Lunch had this aura around it. I mean, it was just a totemic object almost, because it had a dust wrapper designed by Burroughs with some strange sort of Egyptian-style hieroglyphs on it. And it was published by Olympia, of course, and prominently written on it, said not to be imported into the USA or UK. And of course, the contents were banned in Britain because of obscenity, basically.
Right. It went on trial in the US. It was the last book to face an actual obscenity trial.
That's right, in Boston, yes. And it won eventually. But, I mean, it was... Yeah, it was indeed the very last one. It put the final nail in the idea of literary censorship, I think. And I think Bill was quite pleased about that. Although he didn't come over for the trial, he thought maybe he would actually hinder things rather than help them.
Yeah, I wonder how important to Burroughs' identity was the fact that his work attracted that kind of response, that people looked at this collection of paragraphs and chapters that didn't always flow in a logical order, that captured scenes that many found distasteful, that some called obscene, that some people simply said it didn't make sense to them. How important was it to him that people had those conflicted or even negative attitudes toward his work?
I think he always wanted to reach as many people as possible. It's just that he was incapable of writing a really standard commercial work, really. His earliest book, Junkie, was, in fact, based very much on the sort of hard-boiled detective story. You know, Dashiell Hammett, those kind of books influenced him. But when he was writing Naked Lunch, it really began as a series of letters to Allen Ginsberg. In 1953, he had a brief affair with Ginsberg in New York. And then when they broke up, Burroughs went to Tangier and wrote a whole series of letters over maybe a 5 or 6 year period, most of which had these kind of routines in them, which he was writing mainly to try and amuse and please Ginsberg, and possibly even to reignite the affair. It wasn't written as a novel. It was written as a whole series of episodes, which were contained in not just letters to Ginsberg, but letters to other people as well. And also he would read them aloud to his friends. They were just little routines, a routine being some utterly bizarre idea which he would then push to its absolute limit and beyond into some kind of surrealistic, exaggerated ending. Most of which were really, really funny, and some of which were really, really obscene, probably.
Many of which we did not read here on the radio.
Yes. No, exactly. And then, of course, he realized that actually he had a book here, that the letters to Ginsberg was, in fact, a novel, or a book, anyway. It's certainly not the standard bourgeois novel in any sense, because the episodes occur in a completely random order. When the book was being published, it was sent off to the typesetters as each section was typed up, and there was no logical order to it. It was just being sent off, typed up by a group of people who had gathered in Burroughs' room in Paris. And when it came back, he took one look at it, and he moved one section from the beginning to the end, and otherwise he said, "This looks great just as it is." And so there is no character development, there is no story. It's just an episodic book. Based very much like Rabelais or some of the really early novel forms, certainly not Jane Austen. You know, we're talking much, much earlier form than that, really, of just a series of episodes in virtually any order.
There is a literary comparison rarely made with William S. Burroughs, Jane Austen. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR. We're streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. Our guest is Barry Miles, and we're talking about the life of William S. Burroughs. Speaking of that life, it is a life that unfolded in a way one might not have expected to know his parents and the life into which he was born. Born in St. Louis, Missouri, where did William Burroughs come from?
Well, his grandfather invented the adding machine. So he came from a pretty wealthy, sort of almost aristocratic background, you know, mm-hmm. with live-in servants and all of the rest of that. He never had a trust fund or any of the things which Kerouac attributed to him. But his parents did give him $200 a month up until the age of 50. So he was certainly privileged. And, you know, having that kind of privileged upbringing obviously enabled him to write and also enabled him to become a junkie, which is, you know, which was his main subject, of course. So he was always a two minds about whether his upbringing really helped him or hindered him. But anyway, there's nothing he could have done about it.
Yeah,
he always had a tremendous nostalgia, really, for that childhood, you know, just lying in bed, you know, watching the lights move across the wall, you know, from passing traffic, and all the usual nostalgic images that children remember. But except in his case, he drops them into his books. All of his books, in fact, even the very late ones, have references right back to that period.
You wonder, did his parents ever regret or question giving him an allowance of $200 a month, even after it sort of became clear it was being used on drugs and perhaps male hustlers as well?
It's very hard to say. His mother absolutely doted on him, and even late in life said, you know, "I worship the ground you walk on," and all of that kind of thing, which is, you know, just not even very healthy. Really.
Yeah, that'll mess a kid up.
So, and his father just went along with what his mother wanted. And to them, I think 200 wasn't a great deal of money. So they realized that, you know, if he wasn't receiving it from them, I mean, he would probably just finish up in the gutter, I guess. Mm. And he was... from a very early age. He felt different to other men, and he left the country, of course, quite early on. He spent 26 years abroad, didn't return until he was 60 years old in 1974. So all his early books, in fact, all his books up until that point were written out of the country.
Before he left the country, he, as young men of his privilege and generation would do, he went off to Harvard. Describe the Harvard of the early 1930s. What does William Burroughs find there when he gets there?
Well, he was not really a mixer. He didn't join any of the clubs, for instance, and he kept very much to himself. He did very little in the way of study, although he was capable of passing all the exams. I mean, two or three days study before the exam, he always came up with firsts, or A's or whatever. He was very much a loner. He moved in gay circles, but gay circles had to be very discreet in those days. So rather than pick up anyone around Harvard itself, he met a few like-minded people, and they used to always drive down to Manhattan and Harlem, go to gay clubs there. And he was... I mean, it's hard to really imagine what life was like then. The more I looked into it, I mean, it was a life very much of privilege, where you had men servants and all of this kind of thing. And, occasionally he would go and see a silent movie. I mean, we're talking from... He comes from such a long time ago. I mean, I remember once talking to him about his upbringing in St. Louis, and one of his early memories was going for rides with one of his aunts who had a steam car, and you had to stoke this thing up, half an hour before you wanted to go for a drive. It's a world it's almost inconceivable to us now, before any kind of mass entertainment, really. I mean, even the movies were only just starting up. And so... It was a life of study. He investigated all kinds of other areas other than the classics and literature that he was formerly studying, and then he went on and did anthropological research, and did work in New York as well at Columbia University. He was very scholarly. In fact, he finished up moving to Vienna in 1937-38 and trying to take a medical degree there.
But, yeah, what happened with that?
The rise of Nazism, put pay to that, really. He just realized that, that the situation was absolutely untenable, and there's no way he could have finished his degree. And, in fact, something a lot of people don't know about is he married a Jewish woman there in order to get her entry to the U.S. So, basically, he saved her life because her visa to... Yugoslavia, which is where he met her, was about to expire, and the Germans had already passed anti-Jewish laws so that she could not become a citizen of the Reich because she was Jewish. So she would have been in some kind of horrible limbo and undoubtedly finished up in one of the camps had it not been for Burroughs marrying her and bringing her back to the U.S.
And you've mentioned several times that Burroughs was gay, but he was married twice, in fact. What's the story with that? Was there love in those relationships? Were they authentic marriages?
Well, the first one wasn't. They were just friends, and she was about, 12 years older than him, and rather, as he always put it, rather manly. She wore a monocle and everything, and it was much more of a friendship thing. I mean, she was in desperate need, and to him it was really not much of an effort, except that the parents freaked out, of course. But in fact, she didn't in any way abuse what he was doing. I mean, they met once a week for lunch and discussed what was going on. And at the end of the war, they had an amicable divorce, and she went back to Europe. So it was a very, it was a very nice thing to do. He was just being a good guy. The second marriage was much more complicated. Of course, it was to Joan Vollmer, who he shared a flat with, an apartment in. Near Columbia University. It was an astonishing flat, in fact, because Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, William Burroughs, Joan, and several other people lived there. And this is the...
Yeah, to be a fly on the wall in that apartment.
I mean, it's astonishingly that this one apartment held everybody who became the key figures in the Beat Generation. Kerouac obviously then wrote On the Road, and Ginsberg wrote Howl.
But how did Burroughs he end up married to Joan Vollmer?
Well, originally he just moved into the apartment, and they got on extremely well. They shared the same kind of humor, a really ironic, quite sophisticated humor for the time. She had been a journalism student at Barnard, and she was already, I think she'd been married twice already, even though she was still very young. She had a daughter, in fact, the paternity of the daughter was something that beat scholars are forever mulling over. So she wasn't just another rich girl coming down to the big city. She was definitely very much her own person. She would get all the daily newspapers to read the progress of the war and read them in the bath, and people would come in and discuss them with her and everything. So it was obviously not your normal kind of flat share, I think.
somehow they became close enough that he decided.
And then, she became fixated on him. Basically, she knew he was gay. She was prepared to put up with it as long as she had some share of his affections. And he was apparently very much a cold fish, but nonetheless, they did manage to conceive a child and everything. And at one point, we were even arrested down in Texas for driving well under the influence of alcohol and stopping the car and leaping out and making love on the side of the road.
Oh.
Whereupon the local sheriff came along and put Burroughs in jail for the night.
That's apparently
so,
not allowed
so clearly,
in Texas.
Clearly there was a heterosexual side to Burroughs.
We're talking with Barry Miles about the life of William S. Burroughs, the very interesting life, a life that may have infused his literature and may have been even more interesting in many ways. We'd love to have you join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. What are your favorite works? What works have meant the most to you? And if you ever encountered William S. Burroughs during his Lawrence years, which we'll talk about here in a bit, give us a call and tell us what you remember. 816-235-2888, 235-2888. You can also email us with your thoughts at centralstandard@kcur.org. The sexuality was even more complicated than being a gay man who was married, and seems to have been part of Burroughs' life really from his college years all the way up into his elderly years. Is that right?
Yes, I think very early on he realized that he was mainly attracted to men and young men, I suppose. Although not as he never went for children or anything like that. But
younger than 18 in many cases.
Younger than 18, certainly. Yes. This is one of those questions that is always difficult to talk about. I mean, the way of life in the 40s and 50s was very different from now, and things which we now find reprehensible were not even really considered badly in those days, particularly in Paris and in Mexico City and in Tangier, which is mainly where he was hanging out with young boys or young men. In fact, he wasn't very promiscuous. Once he found somebody that he liked, he tended to stay with them, and they would even move in with him quite often, and often for years at a time. So they were relationships, although they were still economically determined. Most of these young boys were doing it for the money. They were not gay. They were just doing it because they needed money. They were poor.
One of those young men became the model for one of his literary works, Junkie. Herbert Hunk or Hunky. What was the? How did he meet him, and how did he become part of Burroughs' life?
Oh, Hunky was a junkie, basically. He came from a wealthy family in Chicago, I think it was. And basically, very early on, he realized that he was gay and he was a transvestite. And in fact, he got thrown out of the family home for hitchhiking while wearing a dress and trying to pick up men. And his father drove by, and that was the end of his family life, really. And he finished up on Times Square working as a hustler, basically, where he was strung out on different types of drugs. And he was there when Burroughs, in order to escape the kind of morality of his very straight upbringing, aristocratic upbringing in St. Louis. He developed a fascination for the low life, for bohemia, for petty criminals, and just There was a book by Jack Black called "You Can't Win," which was the story of a petty thief, basically. And he was fascinated by all this area, and he made a sort of anthropological study, even in New York, of making lists of the different types of people who hung out in different bars. And Hunky became into his life through this. Burroughs had picked up some morphine cigarettes from somebody that had been stolen and was trying to sell them. And Hunky was one of the people he tried to sell them to through a series of connections. Hunky later on claimed, of course, that he was the first person to turn Burroughs onto junk, which wasn't actually true, but he was certainly one around him in the very early days like that. And he managed to ingratiate himself, I suppose, into Burroughs' circle, and finished up, in fact, living like everybody else in this particular apartment on 115th Street. Mm. So, but by then, all the other people had moved out. It was just he and Joan and Burroughs had already moved out at that point. So Hunky became part of the sort of Beat Generation legend, I guess, of someone who was, even in Times Square, where there were some pretty dodgy characters, the police used to call him the Creep. And sometimes they would actually ban him from the square because his behavior was so despicable and, that he would rip off absolutely anybody. For some reason, though, Burroughs found him fascinating and almost like a sort of anthropological study. He wrote about him and enjoyed hanging out with him and hearing his stories because they were so utterly different, I suppose, from his own background.
You mentioned that he was living there still with Joan in the apartment, Joan Vollmer, Burroughs' second wife. Of course, you also write about how the end of that marriage became one of the truly seminal moments in Burroughs' life and the surprising way it ended. We actually have a caller on the line with a question about that. Let's talk to mm-hmm. Babs in Kansas City, Missouri. Babs, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you.
What's your question for Barry Miles?
Well, I had a question. It appears that the sort of details around his wife's, I don't know if you want to call it murder or what, is very controversial because it's not discussed much in regards to his life.
Yeah, well, it has been discussed a great deal, but we haven't talked about it yet. That's a good point. Maybe we should ask Barry Miles to tell us what happened. How did Joan Vollmer die?
It was, to be nice about it, it was a tragic accident. He had been in South America looking for yahe, a hallucinogenic drug, with one of his boyfriends. But it was the boyfriend, a guy called Marker, didn't really reciprocate in any way. He was only there because Burroughs was paying him to be there. They came back to Mexico City, where Burroughs and Joan and her daughter and their son, they already had a son by that point, by Burroughs, were all living. And Burroughs had been back, I think, 2 days, and he was walking down the street one day, having just delivered a knife to be sharpened, and he realized that his face was wet with tears. He was just uncontrollably crying without even being aware of it. And he knew something was really wrong, and he felt a huge depression. And went back to the apartment. Joan wasn't there. She'd already gone on to a drinks party, which was happening. And he started to throw down drinks. He used to drink a great deal at that point. And then he went to join Joan at this drinks party by now early evening. And she, at that point, was basically an alcoholic. She started to drink tequila at about 8 in the morning and just would sip it very slowly all through the day. So they were both in a pretty terrible state, I should imagine, by 7 or 8 in the evening, 7, in fact, in the evening. It was a party going on above a bar called the Bounty Bar, which was run by expatriate Americans. So everyone in the party was American, I think, pretty much. And stupidly, Burroughs at one point suddenly said, let's do our William Tell act. And Joan put a whiskey glass on her head, and Bill whipped out his gun and missed, basically, hit her on the hairline, just below the hairline on her forehead. And of course, she slumped to the ground. The glass didn't break, it just span round and round. And that was the first thing people heard, was just this, after the percussion, was just the sound of this glass turning. And then someone said, my God, Bill, your bullet hit her. And Bill, completely freaked out, and he was tearing his hair out and everything. But as he told me later, it was absolutely idiotic, stupid beyond belief, because even if he'd hit the glass, there would have been shards of glass flying around the room. I mean, it was an act of drunken madness, basically, and so stupid that he believed that it must have been some kind of occupational, some evil spirit had taken over, which became really the theme of his life, was to try and change that part of him which made him behave so stupidly and badly. He told me, in fact, a number of times that he dreamt of her all the time and thought of her every single day, and right up until, the day he died, I think. It was just this pivotal point in his life, and obviously hers. He was charged, of course, with criminal imprudentia criminale, and it took a long, long time for the trial to come up, and he was given 2 years suspended sentence.
So to answer Bab's question, it sounds like maybe he did get away with murder.
I think he did. Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk more about the life of William S. Burroughs with Barry Miles, author of a new biography about that life. We're going to focus in the second half of our show about some of the years that Burroughs spent right here in our listening area in Lawrence, his last couple decades of his life he spent here. Why? And what did he come here for? And how did he change the community that he became part of? Call us with your thoughts at 816-235-2888. If you ever encountered Burroughs, we'd love to hear from you. 235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Stay with us. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. Today we are talking about the life of William S. Burroughs, the literary giant who was a defining figure for the Beat Generation, but who spent the last two decades of his life in Lawrence, Kansas. Our guest is Barry Miles, author of Call Me Burroughs, A Life, a new biography out today. If you have memories or thoughts about Burroughs during those years in the 80s and 90s when he lived in Lawrence, or even before, give us a call at 816-235-2888. Barry, I want to step away from the literary significance of Burroughs for a minute to talk a little bit about the time he spent in Lawrence. And by all accounts, to understand why he came or the impact he had on the town, we have to talk about James Grauerholtz. Who is James Grauerholtz?
James was a young man from Kansas who was fascinated by the Beats when he was still at college, or at high school, I think, even. And he wrote to both Ginsberg and Burroughs. It turned out that Burroughs was actually living in London at the time, so they didn't meet. But he did manage to meet Ginsberg. And Alan introduced him to a few people, including Herbert Hunke, actually. And he spent a very interesting visit to New York, went back to Kansas, and then eventually did the sort of standard hippie thing. He put all his records and his guitar into a Volkswagen microbus and drove to the big city and met up with Ginsberg, who said, "Oh, well, Burroughs is here now, and I told him about you and he'd like to meet you." And literally within a few days, maybe 2 days of arriving in New York, he found himself knocking on Burroughs' door, and they began a short-lived gay relationship, and from then on, they remained very close friends.
Well, KCUR's Frank Morris spoke with James Grauerholtz for a story he's working on about Burroughs' Lawrence years. Let's take a listen.
James Grauerholtz grew up in Coffeyville, Kansas, and went to KU in 1969. He spent 4 years in Lawrence getting acquainted with a storied assortment of counterculture hellions. Then he went to New York and met William Burroughs in 1974. They were together until Burroughs' death 23 years later. I caught up with Grauerholtz at an opening of William Burroughs' art in Lawrence. Grauerholtz says there are lots of reasons why Burroughs left the big city to come to Kansas, but there was also a plan.
I mean, he voluntarily came here, but I lured him. And it was a plan to get him away from New York, the fame, the media, the thrill seekers,
easy access to heroin, panhandlers, the high rents. But William S. Burroughs could have picked a lot of places. He lived in Boulder for almost 3 years in the late 70s. He knew what it was like to live in a college town where he could have pets and get out of town easily for some target shooting. He'd visited lots of such places on speaking tours, Madison, Eugene, others.
So he chose Lawrence out of a list of places, including Tallahassee and all these other places I mentioned. And he chose it over Boulder.
Why? What put it over those places?
I was here. He really knew Lawrence, and he knew my friends.
So Burroughs falls in immediately with Grauerholt's friends in Lawrence, writers, artists, troublemakers, music producers. Oh, let's go. Burroughs wrote this song, Old Lady Sloan, for the Mortal Micronauts, which at that time were just a bunch of Lawrence High punks. With his frequent readings on campus, his storied trips to Dillon's to buy cat food, visits from famous writers like Allen Ginsberg and Hunter Thompson, famous musicians like Laurie Anderson, Patti Smith, and Jello Biafra, he became an institution in the town.
So William adopted Lawrence in 82. And it's taken a few decades for Lawrence to adopt William more fully.
Long after Burroughs' death, when Boog Heiberger, who was on the city council then, proposed naming a park, nature walk, and creek after Burroughs, there was a fair amount of dissent. Many Lawrence residents had no trouble coming up with alternative role models, sports figures, anyone, but a guy who accidentally shot his wife to death, had written about sleeping with boys, and was, of course, a very serious hard drug user much of his life. But ultimately, the proposal passed. And Grauerholtz says that the same liberal libertarian qualities that made Lawrence attractive to Burroughs were amplified or validated by him. He says Burroughs is still the dean of the Lawrence Underground.
There's something called the genius loci, which means the spirit of a place. And he, within a year or two, became the spirit of the place.
Grauerholtz and the large crew of people associated with Burroughs there see Burroughs as a one-of-a-kind, indelible, and serious hipster credential, cementing Lawrence as the Austin of Kansas.
And now it is my hope that the fact of his association with Lawrence will shine brightly like a beacon to indeed attract the different and the strange and the alien and the intelligent and the daring to this town, lest it turn into Topeka or, you know, Overland Park.
Frank Morris, KCUR News.
Talking today with Barry Miles, author of a new biography about the life of William S. Burroughs. Yours is the first biography of Burroughs to include these Lawrence years, Barry. What do you think was most significant about them?
I think he finally had come to the end of the road, and he, after some very hectic years in New York, where he was surrounded by, some hard drug users and a very tough lifestyle. Actually, he was constantly bothered by people who they all wanted him to write introductions or make introductions, on his behalf. Or generally, he couldn't get very much work done. He was taking far too much in the way of drugs, although he eventually got on the methadone program. And then the landlord doubled the rent, and he thought, enough. What he really wanted secretly or hadn't really come to fully to full consciousness yet was to buy his own property somewhere he could have some cats and where he could paint and shoot and do all the things that he wanted to do and get away from the celebrity culture that he had somehow become the center of. I mean, the thing about Burroughs was that each town he lived in, he was a very different person. When he was in Tangier, he was known as El Hombre Invisible because he was just so gray and spectral that nobody saw him, even the guides, the invisible man. Even the guides, who are famously hustling in these towns, didn't get on his nerves too much. I mean, he used to make a point of trying to get from one part of Tangier to another without being harassed, and he managed to pull it off eventually. And then when he was in London, he became very much the sort of aristocratic Burlington Bertie kind of character. I mean, he was a dandy almost. He lived just down the road from the Queen. He lived in the most expensive piece of real estate on earth, pretty much, the St. James's area, just off Piccadilly. And he moved in those kind of circles. He had a lot of aristocratic friends, almost all of them gay. And you know, he fitted right into that the gentleman's club sort of scene there. When he was in Paris, he was in the Beat Hotel and had an entirely different group of friends there. They were mainly much younger American expats, for instance. In New York, he became the center of a sort of drug culture. He was looked up to as the guy who had who'd gone there and experienced it and then come back and reported on it and told everyone about it, which put him in a position of a sort of godfather of punk, he was known. What he really wanted to was silence and quiet. And so he moved out to Lawrence, which was very convenient for him because, for a start, James had already moved out there 2 or 3 years earlier. Because after they'd had a relationship, James still remained a close friend of his and became his secretary, really, and amanuensis. I mean, he ran William Burroughs' communications. And then he realized, I don't have to be in New York to do this. I can do it all from Lawrence. It's basically dealing with publishers, dealing with translators, planning reading tours and things, and that can be done from anywhere. So he moved back to Lawrence, where he had all his college friends still. And Burroughs came out to visit a few times. And it's true he had lived in Boulder for a number of years, but he was mainly there because his son was living and dying there, in fact, and critically ill and couldn't really leave Boulder. Burroughs didn't like Boulder. As he put it, he didn't like mountains, and the mountains in Boulder were cheesy mountains. Cheesy mountains. So there we are. Whereas, obviously, Lawrence doesn't have big mountains on the horizon. So he really liked it. I think he liked the people particularly because they were so straightforward. They just accepted him for what he was. It was a ready-made friendship circle that he could just drop into And, you know, they liked to have a drink, and they weren't into drugs in the way that he was, but they certainly liked to drink, a lot of them. And he could shoot his guns, and then he began keeping cats, and in the end he had about 6 or 7 cats.
Did he actually stop using drugs late in his life?
No, he got onto the methadone program, and he was on it for the rest of his life, pretty much before he left New York even.
It wasn't exactly the quiet retirement he went to seek out there. I mean, he kept recording spoken word recordings. He continued to produce some work. He worked, as we heard in that report from Frank Morris, collaborated with musicians. He was still working.
Oh, not only that. I mean, he had a whole second career as a painter. Which began in the early 80s out in Lawrence. And I mean, most people haven't even seen his paintings, but in fact he had about 40 shows all around the world, in Japan, in Paris, in Basel, Rome, I mean, London, as well, of course, as many, many cities in America.
Describe his paintings. What do they look like?
Well, they're basically abstract expressionist. He first of all... inadvertently created a piece of art when he was doing some shooting practice and shot at a plywood door, and then thought that the striations where the layers of plywood had peeled away looked very interesting. It looked, in fact, like a piece of abstract sculpture. And so he actually regarded it as, after all, most art is simply a question of, you know, art is what you say is art. And so he said that was art. And then he began hanging tubes of paint and cans of paint and things in front of the doors and pieces of wood and shooting at them. And then he began to stick collage elements onto it, you know, pictures torn from newspapers and things. And in the end, he was producing work which bears a sort of, I suppose, a resemblance to something like Robert Rauschenberg's work that's widely shown in America. I mean, you could fit him into the history of art quite easily, actually. Mm. The kind of work he was doing is purely abstract. In terms of artistic talent, I mean, he couldn't draw anything. I mean, he didn't have those kind of formal skills, and he'd never studied those either. But he became, actually, a very good colorist. His eye for color was very acute, actually. He'd already done a lot of scrapbooks and... manuscripts which he would sort of decorate and with different coloured lines and so on, and his scrapbooks often would have colour washes over the text, and he would stick in photographs and collages and did a lot of collage work with photographs, in fact, moving objects around and then photographing them, moving them again, taking another photograph. So he had a... There had always been this strain in his work, but it was once he got to Lawrence, he actually started to do paintings. And like everything else, he really cranked them out, just as he... You know, he was always writing, and then when he became a painter, he was always painting, and he did hundreds and hundreds.
You know, it's an interesting journey as you look back at the whole arc of his life, from really some troubled years and some dangerous or difficult times to what the Boston Globe called, in a review actually of your book, they referred to Burroughs as an elder statesman of cool. How did he get to that place? Who started to think this was actually cool, that he was an arbiter of what would be hip and fashionable?
I think it goes right back to the early days of Naked Lunch. I mean, he was the only living sort of bohemian, really. Certainly when I was in art college in 1959, 60 through a few more years, we would look back on the 20s in Paris as being like the height of sort of cool bohemia. And at the beginning of the 60s, Burroughs represented the only sort of group of people who were living that same life, who were outside of normal bourgeois society, who were not affected very much by consumerism or anything, but were living a purely artistic life, in a sense. And they were outside of the law to a degree. They were very romantic figures, particularly to a teenager like myself, you know, who was going to art college. And I think a lot of disaffected people, a lot of lonely young people, they look at the Beat Generation for another way of living. I mean, when you decide who you're going to be when you're an adolescent, it's almost like a shopping mall. I mean, there are a whole lot of different ways that you could choose to go in, and some people look very much to some kind of bohemian lifestyle, which enables them to travel, enables them to live cheaply and experiment. Usually, these are people with a bit of an artistic temperament, or else, you know, they were very, you know, they were not sporty types, couldn't really fit in with the sports crowd. Mm. I don't know. He was very much someone who, on the outside, that other outsiders found to be a mentor, really, because he touched all bases. I mean, there's so many ways you can look at Burroughs, and you can make your own William Burroughs, really. As a brand, you know, he's very wide. Yeah. and so people do. I mean, to some people, he is the godfather of punk. To other people, they associate him with, you know, very advanced experimentation with cutting up words and working with John Cage and all of these kind of people.
Yeah, which part
of... So it's right across the board, you see.
Sure. Which part of his persona did he most embrace? I mean, what aspect of his work was he most proud of as he looked back on his life?
Well, he always had he changed. As I said, he changed each city he was in. He became almost a different person because whichever group of people he began to hang out with, he took on some of their ideas as well as them being influenced by him. And I would say ultimately, in late interviews done in Lawrence, he still thought that the most important part of his life was the time he lived in the Beat Hotel in the late 50s. When he wrote Naked Lunch, or finished Naked Lunch, and did all the experimentation with cut-ups and collages, and it was a period of ferocious avant-garde activity in the sort of classical avant-garde sense, and he always looked back on that as the most productive period and his greatest contribution to art, shall we say, in a general sense. But of course, you know, he. Most of those people he lost touch with. Brian Gysin was his big friend at that point, and he always remained close to him, except that they lived in different continents. And when Brian died, that was really the end of that era. So I think one would have to say Paris late 50s, early 60s is his crowning achievement.
You've written biographies also of Jack Kerouac and of Allen Ginsberg. I wonder how Burroughs' life compares with theirs. There's no question he was an influential figure for them. How different is his story than theirs?
Well, he was much older, of course. I mean, the notion of a Beat Generation is rather a misnomer because, I mean, Ginsberg was only 17 when he met Burroughs, and Burroughs was then, I think, 30. So, you know, he was almost twice as old as Alan. He was this educated man who had been in Europe a lot before the war. He was seen as a very much as a mentor and who had experimented with drugs, who introduced them to a whole load of different writers, for instance, like Celine and Korzybski and, even Hart Crane, I think Ginsberg hadn't heard of until Burroughs gave him a copy of The Bridge. So he was an elder statesman even back then in the early 40s, 1943, 44. They basically just looked up to him and Kerouac, as we know, turned him into one of his characters, old bull balloon, right. All this kind of thing, and which Burroughs really didn't like. Actually, he thought that all of the names that Kerouac gave for him were rather insulting. Ginsberg felt the same way about Kerouac as well. That he didn't like the portrayal of himself in Kerouac's books.
Well, there's a lot of things that Burroughs doesn't like. In fact, overall, after hundreds of pages, the impression is that it wasn't a very happy life he lived, was it?
No, I don't think it was. I think he was very lonely. He always professed to not feel loneliness at all and to really enjoy silence and being by himself. But that's not really true. I think if you look at his love life, I mean, it was really extreme. I mean, his real ideal was to merge with somebody, which he turned into a series of routines, of course, but he really wanted to have an incredibly close relationship with someone, and rarely did. He had a very brief one with Ginsberg. He had a friend called Ian Somerville in London, who he did live with on and off, or had a long relationship with for many, many years. That was his main relationship in life. But even that, he managed to mess up by getting heavily involved in Scientology, for instance, and Ian really couldn't stand all of that stuff and refused to let him talk about it. And there were a number of occasions when they could have really, and so they broke up. But they could have gotten together. But again, there was a sort of sloppy, careless side to Burroughs, which usually worked to his own disadvantage. And so he never really had any long-term relationships, particularly after he got back to the U.S. in 1974.
Well, it is a fascinating look at a fascinating life. Barry Miles, the author of Call Me Burroughs, A Life. He'll be speaking Thursday night at 7 o'clock at Rainy Day Books in Fairway, and you can contact them or check out our website, kcur.org, for more information. Barry Miles, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
That biography is out today. You can find out more about this or about any of our other broadcasts. You can subscribe to our podcast or hear any previous show at kcur.org. We hope you'll join us tomorrow when we explore the changing landscape of student housing on and around college campuses. Stay tuned now for Up to Date, a look at the infrastructure in Missouri and Kansas. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Kate Baxendale. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.